Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, writer Dennis Hensley talks about going to rehab. But did he really need to be there?
I went to rehab. There I was, sitting in these rooms with people who had been lifelong alcoholics, people who had opioid addictions, cocaine. I ended up here, and I didn't have their problems necessarily in terms of chemical dependency or history of addiction, but my life fell apart, and this seems like a pretty good place to reckon with it.
Today on the show, writer-director Dennis Hensley talks about going to rehab for reasons he didn't even realize. Stick around.
Hey, this is Dennis Hensley. You're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. Now, I hope you guys enjoyed the story last week with actor-filmmaker Andre Hyland. Do you know Andre Hyland, Dennis?
I do not.
You will know him.
Okay, good.
He's so talented and so funny. He has out a movie right now on Showtime called The Fourth, which is about one day in the life of the 4th of July.
Oh, cool.
Here in Los Angeles.
Right.
And then he has a short that was in Sundance a couple of years ago called Funnel. And that's really, it's only 8 minutes long, but it's really good. You guys should go to YouTube and look up Funnel. Anyway, he told a great story about being at the dentist as a child, and then an unfortunate incident happens. But I'm not going to tell you what it is.
What could possibly... So many unfortunate episodes can happen at a dentist.
It's true. Yeah. I'm not going to tell you. You got to go back. You got to listen to Andre Hyland, but not today because I'm here with Dennis Hensley. Hensley, is it?
That right? Is correct.
Hensley, exactly. And you bring forth the topic, my brief tragic affair with Klonopin.
Yes.
And so, you know, obviously we're going to talk about Klonopin.
Right.
Which is a drug.
It is a drug.
And a powerful drug. So every time I've been put on, what do you call it? Is it an opioid or?
Well, I think Klonopin is a benzodiazepine, which is the class of drugs that's like Valium and Xanax and Klonopin. Those are sort of the main people in that sort of field of drugs. I don't think it's considered an opioid.
I see. Well, nonetheless, every time, like after a surgery, whether it was my C-section or I had a kidney out or, you know, the different surgeries I've had, and they give me Vicodin.
Right.
I always would take about like 2.5 or 3, maybe 4 over the first couple of days.
Right.
And then it just made me sick to my stomach. Like I was so sensitive to that medicine and I never felt a high from it. Possibly because I smoke marijuana and I know what high feels like, and it didn't feel like that.
Right, so it wasn't for you. That's good.
Never for me.
Yeah, I've never done Vicodin, so I don't think.
Yeah, well, Vicodin, every time I've taken that, it just makes me sleepy.
Yeah.
But I've never done, you know, what I see on TV and what you're going to talk about, I imagine. You know, I've never had that experience getting high off of a pill, as it
were.
I guess I'm probably in the minority.
Right, and I don't even know if I actually got high from it, but it was sort of helping me in some ways, I thought, manage some symptoms that I was dealing with.
Yeah, okay.
But then when I tried to get off it, it was not having it.
Well, that's just it. That's what
it
people
would not
were
release
saying.
Me.
And I watch, probably because I sit around watching Intervention.
Right.
Drinking a bottle of red wine. And
it's the best way to watch Intervention.
Judging them. And so many people are hooked. And it's, sorry, your chair is so squeaky.
That's okay.
Yeah, I need to.
It's all good.
I actually did put the WD-40 on it.
Yeah.
But I guess it didn't work.
It's all right.
I guess. I mean, you know, if we have to. So listen, you have this podcast, Dennis Anyone.
Yes, I do.
Which I think is such a clever title, Dennis Anyone.
Thank you.
I think that makes me laugh.
Some
so
people
hard.
Have heard of like Tennis Anyone.
Yeah.
And other people haven't heard of it, but it's okay. I like it.
I play tennis. So
thank
I,
you.
I know that, and I think it makes me laugh.
Yeah.
And it makes me laugh.
Good.
Anyway, you've had so many episodes, over like 300, and we've had several of the same guests on.
We've had some overlap, I'm sure.
Yeah, for sure. Like Lana Turner and Matt McConkey.
Oh, yeah, Matt McConkey.
Yeah, McConkey.
Recently for me, yeah.
Yeah, Frank DeCaro.
Yes.
And So delightful. Yeah, super fun. And yeah. So you've been going and going.
We both love to interview people.
We do. And I'm very curious. Are you also curious?
Yes. I want to know what people's stories are. And I'm genuinely interested.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that do like talk shows or different things who aren't really that interested in other people. And yet they've chosen that. I think they like the... I don't know, maybe the comedy part of it or whatever, but I'm genuinely interested in people. And my background is magazine writing, and my start of my career as a writer, writing profiles of actors, actresses usually, for magazines like Movie Line and Cosmo and stuff.
Sure.
And so when magazines started to fizzle away, I started the podcast because I loved to do it.
To do that.
And I feel like I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing when I'm doing it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I feel like it's in my element. And yes. I feel like there needs to be more people that don't necessarily have to be the center of attention, although I don't mind that. But right. That can be the conduit to focusing on somebody else.
My high is when you get the thing out of the person and are able to bring it to the audience.
Yeah.
Like, it's like prospecting for gold.
Yeah.
It's like there's nuggets in there, and if you ask the right question or give them the right space or whatever, they will deliver, and that, to me, is a rush.
Yeah, and it's also asking the questions that provoke a thoughtful answer rather than the same old questions. Because before I have a guest on, I do my very best to look into them, honestly, for a couple of days, because I'll just have their, you know, podcasts on, right. Or I'll have them being interviewed on other shows on in my earbuds.
Right.
So whether I'm at the gym or, you know, same way we all listen to podcasts. So I'm listening to the guest before I sit down with them because I don't want to be repetitive. And the idea of story-worthy is to jump right into a story so right. that we're not asking, where are you from?
Right.
Where did you go to school? Because if we've already tuned in to hear Dennis Hensley, then we know that.
That's right.
I don't know that about you.
Right.
I'm not that interested. No, I am. I'm kidding. Hey, Dennis, I want to tell you about this new investing app that I just found.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Robinhood. This app, Robinhood, works for everybody, not just wealthy people. It's simple and intuitive, and it has this clear design with data presented in a really easy-to-digest way.
Yeah.
So if you're just starting off in the stock market and you want to invest with true confidence, then Robinhood is for you. And here's the thing. There's no cost to you. There's no commission fees. I mean, other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, but Robinhood doesn't charge commission fees at all. You can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. And like I said, it's easy to understand. I mean, you can place a trade with just 4 taps on your smartphone. Learn how to invest as you build your portfolio. You can discover new stocks and track your favorite companies with a personalized news feed. You can get custom notifications for price movements so you never have to miss the right moment to invest. I'm telling you, Robinhood is so easy to understand. It's like the perfect way to get into the stock market. And right now, Robinhood is giving Storyworthy listeners a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help build your portfolio. Sign up right now at storyworthy.robinhood.com. That's storyworthy.robinhood.com. You won't believe how simple it is. I am anxious, though, to hear your story about Klonopin, because, like I said, I haven't really had this experience. And I feel like I know where it's going to go, but I'm not positive. So I don't want to know. That's
okay. You want to be on the edge of your seat?
No, I want to be where the audience is, on the edge of my seat, and I know I will be.
Well, when I was thinking about stories to do, there were some that were lighter and that had more, like, kind of pop culture elements. I used to work on a cruise ship. I auditioned for Madonna as a dancer. And then I thought, no, this was the one that was, like, sad and hard and difficult and meaningful and crazy.
They mean
and
the most.
So I thought, I'm going to, you know what, let's do that one.
I think those stories translate the most when it means something to you. However,
and I'm still making sense of it. I think I was kind of like, what are the lessons from it and what can I share? And I was making notes. And I was like, I don't quite know yet.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's the story I'm going to tell.
Okay. Well, I'm excited. But you just mentioned Madonna and a cruise ship. So
yes.
Was that one show or was that 2 different shows?
No, it was 2 different shows. My first job really in entertainment and show business was working as a dancer / assistant cruise director for Princess Cruises.
Oh my God.
I was in my early 20s, right out of college. I got to travel the world. It was living the Love Boat dream, but we worked like dogs. Like we were doing bingo in the afternoon and this and that. And then we'd go do 2 shows at night. And then we'd have midnight rehearsals.
Right.
It was hard.
Really hard.
But
they keep you so busy.
Yes. But I got to travel. It opened up my world in such a major way. And during one of those breaks, I auditioned as a dancer for Madonna's Blonde Ambition tour, which was the big Truth or Dare tour. And the experience of auditioning for her was so rich and funny to me. Like, I wanted it, but I also dreamed of, like, we were going to become best friends. And, but I also know that was crazy. So I wrote an article about it, like a first-person story. First thing I'd ever really seriously written in that way. And I liked the way it turned out, and I thought, I'm going to try to get this published. So I started sending query letters first, and then a few people wanted to read the article. And ultimately, Movie Line Magazine, there was an editor there that loved my voice and liked the story, and he published it, and he started giving me jobs. So I got a writing career because Madonna rejected me.
Yeah, that is so interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, that is, and everybody has a story where, you know, things start and you just never know, I guess, where it's going to come from. I'm so excited you're here and I can't wait to hear your story. But first, you guys, I want to remind you to follow me on Twitter and Instagram. Not that you don't already do that. But here's a great idea. Why not head over to Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts? Because now they got that.
Right, I can't keep up.
There's a lot of different ways to listen, and
you're doing
your
whole podcast universe much more effectively than I am. I'm impressed.
No excuse not to do it. So you guys get over there and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Google. It's right there on your phone. It's totally free. And then also rate Storyworthy. Would you do that and review Storyworthy? That is so kind when people do that.
Yeah, it makes a difference too.
It really does. It does make a difference, and it kind of like, you know, it's just like a little bit of a like a little light goes on. And then, you know, it's over. But it for a second there,
it's a nice little line.
It's a nice little feeling.
Yeah.
All right, you guys, he's here right now, Dennis Hensley. He has written for In Style, Glamour, Us, Cosmopolitan, and Out. He's also, and Out. He's published the novels Misadventure in the 213 and Screening Party. And you co-wrote the feature film Testosterone. I never heard of that.
It was Sonia Braga, Jennifer Coolidge,
Antonio
Sabato Jr.
Amazing.
It was this kind of twisty, darkly comic gay thriller.
Yeah,
and set in Argentina. It was fun.
Your television credits also include Love Spring International with Jane Lynch.
Which delightful.
I adored. That show was so funny.
You know, it was before its time or something. It was a great gig.
Why can't they bring that back and put
it up on
the TV?
Oh my God, that would be amazing. It would be amazing.
If you haven't seen Love Spring International, you guys, it's about like a dating service in Beverly Hills.
Yeah. But it's actually a Beverly Hills finest dating service located in Tarzana. Like, they build themselves as a Beverly Hills dating service, but they're not in Beverly Hills.
Not even there,
that gives you an idea. Yeah
exactly. You also, of course, were on Fashion Police with Joan Rivers.
I was one of the writers,
And the Big Gay Sketch Show, and you wrote for that.
I did. Awesome. Kate McKinnon was on that show.
Oh, yeah. She's fantastic,
I had a feeling that she might go places.
Yeah. Did you really?
Yeah.
Are you just saying that?
Everybody on that show was super talented. And they've all gone on to do really great things. But she was a powerhouse,
extraordinary.
Man. Yeah.
Yeah, extraordinary. And I remember after, you know, the whole election thing in 2016, the way she performed on Saturday Night Live, you know, doing Hillary Clinton, that was so poignant.
The Hallelujah song at the piano.
Yeah, it was so, like, she pulled it together. Like, people were clinging to her.
They needed somebody to help them.
Everybody was in such shock, et cetera. Anyway, we'll not bring that up.
That was a thrill to work with her.
Yeah, I bet. And you're also the host and the producer of that interview podcast we talked about, Dennis Anyone, with Dennis Hensley.
Yeah.
And you are the creator and host of the longtime LA stage hit, The Mismatch Game. So that's the game show.
Yeah, it's like a parody of the old Match Game TV show.
I can't believe I haven't seen it.
It's super fun. I will let you know the next time we do it. We probably do it like two or three weekends a year, and the money goes all to the Gay and Lesbian Center's homeless youth program.
That's amazing.
And the performers are really outrageously funny and laugh. It's one of the great nights out.
Yeah,
for just
bang
15
for
bucks.
Your buck. Yeah. Oh, I can't wait. I'd like to see that very
much.
It's
super fun.
And then you also have the new tabletop party game, You Don't Know My Life.
Yes, and it's so funny. It grew out of my interviews, because over the years of doing the celebrity interviews for magazines, I started this list of sort of offbeat questions I would ask. Because I found over the years that they got fun anecdotes out of people.
Yeah.
And now we're in phase one of our friends and family launch campaign. So we're taking pre-orders now, and then we'll have it in people's hands for Christmas.
There you go. You find it over there at youdontknowmylifegame.com. And you can find Dennis over on Twitter at Hensley Dennis. All right, you guys, whoever you are, put your hands together for Dennis Hensley.
All right, so it was the spring of 2015. I had had a rough couple of years. I had gone on strike from the TV show Fashion Police in the spring of 2013. I was in the Writers Guild and the show wasn't, and there was this big movement to try to get it there, and it was a tough situation all the way around. Long story short, I did what I thought was right, and I was part of the strike. And the follow-up of that, the fallout from it, kind of played out over like a year or two, and I got some jobs here and there, but like all my sort of worst fears about what might happen kind of happened. And it started taking a really bad toll on my health. I had digestive problems. I had sleep problems. It was a sort of delayed reaction to this big thing that had happened. And so at one point I thought, you know what? About 8 or 9 years ago, I had a period of real intense anxiety and depression related to work stuff. And so I took Effexor, like an antidepressant that really helped me, and along with a little bit of Klonopin, you know, like a quarter, a couple of times a day, that it helped me. So I thought, I'm just going to try that sort of thing again, right? So I started doing that, and after about a month and a half, my digestion got a little better and my sleep got a lot better. And I'm like, okay, I'm in a better place. I'm gonna stop doing the Klonopin, right? So I'd only been doing it like for a month and a half, and I've been doing less than a pill a day. I do like a quarter. And because I'm quite a lightweight, I was raised Mormon. I never smoked. I never drank. I never did drugs. I tried smoking pot once. And I went to see the movie Alexander with Colin Farrell with a friend of mine after smoking pot. And I just realized I wasn't high enough for this stuff. But anyway, so I was that guy. I never drank. It was never my thing. And so here I was trying to help myself with this medication. And I thought, okay, I feel like I'm doing a little better. I need to come off this because I don't want to abuse it. I don't want to take it too much. And I started to come off it, and I couldn't. There would be these sort of zaps in my head. I don't know how to describe it. And I was taking so little that there wasn't a lot of waning to do. Whenever I tried to do it, I couldn't. And I went and saw my psychiatrist, and we talked about it. And they said there's this thing called benzodiazepine withdrawal syndrome. I can't remember if that's not exactly what it is. Some people that take these drugs have this kind of a problem. But often they've been taking them for a lot longer. So there was one night where it was so bad, the physical sensations, but also I was kind of a mess. Like this has been a long couple of years of not feeling well, and trauma and fallout and all of that. So I called, I was like, I need to go to the hospital. I need help. I can't deal with this. So I said to my psychiatrist, I said, what do people do? And she recommended a place in Glendale called GADS, which is Glendale Adventist Alcohol and Drug Services or something like that. And so I went into the hospital. I checked into the hospital. I had like 3 days withdrawal. And it was not that physiologically intense, like there was some discomfort and weird brain zappy, weird things, but it was just so, I needed a place to fall apart. And so I just fell apart in this hospital because all of the struggle of the last couple of years came out. But in order for me to have my insurance cover what I'd done at the hospital, I had to go to outpatient rehab for 2 months. So I check out of the hospital, and then I start my program, and you're there like, I think it was like four times a week, outpatient, you know, 12-step program and group meetings. And you had to go to two or three meetings a week on your own, AA meetings in, you know, in your neighborhood or whatever, 12-step meetings, and you had to get things signed. It's, you know, the normal, I went to rehab. But I'd never done any drugs or alcohol in any sort of meaningful way, even socially, until like you know, just the period of time before that. But there I was sitting in these rooms with people who had been lifelong alcoholics, people who had opioid addictions, cocaine. And what was interesting about it was that I never really entertained, like, oh, what am I doing here? This isn't who I am. I felt like I ended up here, and I didn't have their problems necessarily in terms of chemical dependency or history of addiction, but my life fell apart, and this seems like a pretty good place to reckon with it, because you could really be honest about what was going on. And when that's happening, it's very intense, because it's an intense period of time, and you have to go to your meetings, and you have to get your thing signed, and if you don't, their insurance isn't going to cover it, and like, you have to show up and do it. And I was still not well, and I still wasn't working that much, and it was a lot to deal with. But I remember being very moved at the people, and I remember by the end of it, I felt like I had gotten some validation for being a good listener and for helping other people sort of process and talk through, and that sort of felt good. And I remember also there was a friend of mine, like a young guy that was there, a gay guy named Peter, and we sort of became friends at the end, or at least for the end for me. And he was somebody that was young and in his 20s, his parents didn't accept that he was gay, and he had been in and out of different rehabs for a long time, really struggling. And we used to hang out socially, and we would go to the movies. And I remember one time we went to Chipotle for lunch. And then afterwards, I found out that he had gone out and used again. And then he was, you know, then he'd gone back to rehab or whatever. Like, he'd kind of gotten back on track after that one time. And I joked with him. I was like, you looked into we had lunch at Chipotle, and you saw what your future as a middle-aged gay man might look like, and you decided, screw this, I need to go get loaded. I can't, that's too sad. Even, no, we laughed, and we joked, but a few months later, I was working on a cruise ship. We had talked about this before. I was putting up one of the shows on the cruise ships, and you're a little out of touch when you're out there, and we pulled into port in Fort Lauderdale on the day we were going to get off the ship, and I had all these texts from people in rehab, and I was like, oh shit. I knew what it was. And he had passed away. And it was like, it was so surreal that I would even have a rehab friend, that I would even have been there. And that then to lose him that way, and the sadness of his story. And he was sweet and beautiful, and I wanted to tell this story because I'm not quite sure what it meant in the big picture for my life, and but it was powerful. And I think one of the things I noticed during the time of it was that you get pretty used to being real with other people in those situations, and other people being real with you. And I remember going to a big social event, like right in the middle of it, a big Outfest opening night film festival party with a lot of friends. One of my favorite things to do all year. And we're at the after party, and it's outside, and people are having fun. And I was thinking, everybody seems so phony. Like, all of my friends even seem phony or affected or a little, it was a little different. I'd gotten so used to people being brutally real, not rude to each other, but like, you know, today I felt like this and I wanted to jump off a building, you know, like things have gotten very real, that even sort of your pedestrian social niceties, that affect that kind of people do, felt a little like jarring to me. And I thought that was a really striking thing. I think it helped me to appreciate real interactions, whether they're, you know, casual, somebody you just met, or somebody you've known longer, like trying to get to the authenticity, both as a someone that's communicating and also listening and interacting with other people. That's something that really stayed with me from that time. And the other thing I really appreciated was about the program. It didn't seem like they were interested in preserving the image of AA or this big organizational thing. I think their job is to just help people not drink, like, or not use or whatever. And I think that's part of the rules and the structure when you go there. But I was really impressed with that. It was like they had one job, and that was to help people be sober, stay sober. And I just was really impressed with how it all worked. And the humanity and people going in. And, you know, and because we had to go to other meetings, I happened to have a job down in Culver City, and I had to go to a meeting down there. And so I went into that one, and there was a lot of veterans. And it was the last place I ever expected to be, and I also felt like it was the place that I needed to be. Because, if you told my friends, like, that I would end up in rehab, like, I never did any... I was the one that they couldn't get me to take a drink, even in college when everyone was partying. It was just never my thing. It was just so interesting that I ended up there. And at the time, it was so all-encompassing, because you're like, oh my God, this is so intense, and here I am, and it feels like it's going on a long time. It's like weeks after weeks of showing up 4 times a week. And then how will this... Will I always be here, or will this... And now I kind of look back and it goes, oh, that was a little chapter. And there's like one person that I see on Facebook from time to time. But it wasn't like, oh, and I met that person and we were... And then they went in this direction. It was sort of like this holiday in this land. And what was also kind of really strange about it was in the late 2009-2010 era, I had started writing this play about somebody who fakes an addiction to help their career. It was about a writer who couldn't catch a break and just felt like the business was done with him. Like that he was old, that they were bored with, that he needed to be seen in a different way. So I'm going to fake this addiction. Everyone's going to see me different. I'm much more interesting now, and doors are going to open, right? So in like 2014, I reconnected with a friend that I'd worked on a previous project with. I mentioned that idea to him in passing over lunch, and he said, I really love that idea. I want to develop it with you. So we outlined a story together, and I ended up writing the screenplay called Bender, about a writer who fakes an addiction to help his career. And the night I finished the first draft one night, and the next day I checked into rehab.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? Like, I remember going to the Glendale Adventist Medical Center for the detox and the whole thing, and I brought in like a stack of pages to edit, and it was just so... It was so almost like prescient or something. It was really kind of weird, but I was able to use a lot of my experiences to inform that story. Certainly I remember being in one meeting, and there was this old man there. He was like in his 80s, and he was like, you know, this week was all about roller coasters for me. And I was like, oh, I think he's going to talking about like ups and downs, emotionals. No, he literally went back east to ride on all these wooden roller coasters. It was his passion. And he was like in his 80s. And so I was like, oh, that's going in the script, you know? So just little things like that about little details about how things were. But I don't quite know what it was meant to illuminate for me, or why that happened to me. I've since read another friend had trouble with a similar drug, kind of put through hell from the withdrawals, was on it much longer than I was, but I think there's definitely some cautions around that kind of stuff. But I also feel like I needed a place to fall apart, and I needed that kind of support around me, even though my problems weren't the same, that it was important for me to be there. I was in the right place.
I think you should write the short should be called Rehab Holiday.
Rehab Holiday. Yeah. I like that title.
I think that is so interesting. You're such an unlikely candidate to be in rehab.
Yeah.
How did your friend Peter die?
He overdosed on heroin.
Yeah. And that's why he was there to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had been struggling with it on and on and on. And I do remember one, there was family week where people would come. And that was so weird too, is like I would have friends come for, you had to bring somebody, right? Yeah. So there were friends of mine that didn't know this, anything, it didn't make sense for them. But they were so lovely to sit there with me in these meetings. And they were emotional and you would cry. And I wasn't sitting there like, this isn't my problem. It was, it connected to my problems, which was this feeling of like having your life fall apart and your body and your nervous system sort of betray you. And so the emotions of it were all really real. But I think of the friends that would come and be in those meetings with me. But anyway, there was one where Peter's parents came in and I was in the other room, so I wasn't there. But it was incredibly intense because they talked, you know, about his sexuality. And anyway, it's still sad. I have an answering machine message on my phone from him that I listen to from time to time. It's crazy that I look back and I'm like, I can't believe that was part of my story, but it really was.
Yeah. Well, but like you said, it's a chapter in your life. And if you live for 85 years, then, you know, there was that year and a half that you took that little spin on Klonopin. How long?
I wasn't on Klonopin long. I was on Klonopin for like a month and a half.
6 weeks.
I had taken it years ago, effectively.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you did you get that prescription to begin with? What was the original?
The original one, I got it from my psychiatrist.
But why would they give you that? Is it a mood-altering thing?
Yeah, it was.
I see.
Yeah, it was a... It was something to help with anxiety and depression.
I see.
And when I started having problems again, I started treating it the same way I did with that, because it had worked before. But what I learned in the subsequent year and through a few other misadventures, was that my symptoms weren't that. They were more of a PTSD type stuff. And once I started treating it like trauma, as opposed to sort of anxiety and depression, I was able to find treatments that helped and got better. It made a huge difference when I was able to shift. So I was using that medication because it had helped me before, but it turns out that what I was dealing with physiologically.
So do you put that on your same, like your card now? Like, no Klonopin, please.
Yeah, like it was, you know, when you were, and I was still having a lot of issues, and it was that thing of like, you want to get it out of the house, throw it, flush it down the ground. All of those things that you see in the intervention shows and the movies of like, get it, you don't even want it in the house.
Right.
That all happened during that time.
What did you do when you first walked into the rehab in Glendale? You said, hello, my name is Dennis Hensley, and I
told
do
them
not
my story.
Feel well.
I said, I cannot, I've been taking this drug for a while, and I cannot come off it. So when I start to come off it, the physical sensations are so, the word I think of is terror. It's
did
like
you
you're being
look
terrorized.
It up online, like what was going on?
Yeah, and there are, normally it's not that big of a deal, but there are these cases where people have, maybe it's called protracted benzodiazepine withdrawal. There's a word for it that happens sometimes. It's like a syndrome for some people on these type of drugs who have a really hard time coming off of them.
Yeah, I mean, any drug can affect anybody differently. You know, when they talk about Ambien, how some people can go out and, you know, rob a store, come home, go to bed, never knew it happened.
Right.
So, I mean, I totally believe you. But so what did they do? You go in and the first step is, okay, sit in this group and talk to these people.
The first step is you go to the hospital and they get you off of it. They stop.
But
you
what
stop
do you do?
It.
But what do you do physically during the day? You are walking around, watching TV
in the hospital.
In the lounge.
I am watching The Perks of Being a Wallflower on DVD.
Okay.
And crying, and I'm watching it twice: once with the director's cut, and once without it.
I never saw that.
Oh, I love that movie,
Perks of Being a Wallflower. Mm-hmm. What's it on?
It was a feature film with Emma Watson, and it's based on a best-selling young adult novel, and I don't know, it just spoke to me so much about the power of friendship. And
that's sweet.
But I also remember, like, a minister coming in and giving me, like, this book of prayers and stuff.
Yeah.
And he was lovely. I mean, it was Glendale Adventist, so there's a religious association, but I just remember sobbing.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't just about the drugs not being able to get off it. It was this culmination of... This was a long time coming.
Yeah, you were just tired.
And this thing had happened, and it was still being processed. And also, I wasn't working. I couldn't find a place to be. So it was a time for sure.
And
but I remember
did you stop
crying
using
to that,
psychiatrist?
I ended up switching, not just because it wasn't a good fit. I found that
Well, he put you on the wrong thing.
Well,
did you ever call him and say, "Hey, man, I'm
we've tried
losing it."
No, I did, and also, and it was, so we would try something else or whatever. But I started. What I found out was that I realized that I wasn't totally communicating with him very well because I felt like a failure, a bit like I fucked that one up too, because we couldn't. It was so we tried this thing and then we tried that thing and that didn't work. And I just felt like it was hard for me. I felt like I felt responsible.
Yeah.
Like I'm not a good patient. So I did make a switch. And the irony of all of this story was that the strike was the instigator of all of this. And it was the first time in
the
my
writer's
life.
The strike.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was the first time, I think, in my life where I really stood up for myself and my own values. Throughout my life, I'd always acquiesce. And I learned through this whole process, the rehab and the aftermath, of why that might be true of myself. The irony is, I stood up for myself for the first time. It went horribly.
Hmm.
But the takeaway is now I can't not do that.
Interesting.
Isn't it? I stood up for myself. It went bad, and now I stand up for myself all the time.
Well, it's like a level of maturity.
And that's
maturity.
A huge.
And
that
it's
was a
age.
Huge thing for me.
Yeah, it's age. It's maturity. It's just getting the past behind you and all that. And also, it's. I think it's like just in LA and maybe other cities as well. There's a cynicism, and that you do see with people like out at a party or whatever, you can quickly see who's being, you know, fake, as it were. But I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It's just there's certain, you know, niceties that we go about when we're in a space with people we don't know.
Yeah. And
I
also,
don't think
it was also people, they were my friends. They were like my really good friends.
But that's okay. I mean,
yeah, it just was interesting to me.
Because you were like tripping on being sober.
And also, yeah, and just being in
present.
These meetings where. Everybody was real.
Yeah. But you're visiting this group of people who are so honest and so truthful, and they're just not going to deal with any BS, and they see right through you.
Right.
And you respected that.
Yeah. It was very powerful.
It is powerful.
For sure.
It's still powerful.
Yeah.
It makes me sort of want to go to a meeting, you know, and just kind of like, oh, this is a whole other group of people. Who knew?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mentioned the screenplay that I was writing about. And one of the big things that happens to the character in that, he fakes this addiction to help his career, but he finds that he connects with the community because he's able to be himself, he's able to be honest, and they don't have meetings for losers.
Yeah.
An addict is so much better than loser, and he was a fucking loser.
Mm.
And everyone could smell it on him. Somebody that I've talked to about this, and also people that have read the screenplay have thought, you know, there should be meetings for all kinds of stuff, not just addiction. And in other words, there's not really a place to go if you're...
Well, but there are. There's senses, you know, there's places of community, like a yoga class where you might know other people.
Right.
Or, I mean, that's what people go to church, right? They gather together and they have this common faith and that's their community.
Right.
Or you might have it at, you know, your kid's school or I don't know.
But it's important
groups,
to have
like
some
that.
Kind of connection like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you're not kidding, right?
Yeah,
you're not kidding. So let me ask you about Dennis Anyone.
Yes.
I think it's such a clever... Well, I mean, it's not that far off of what I'm doing with Storyboard.
It's very similar.
But what do you do? What is the difference?
I love to talk to mostly creative people that are writers or actors or landscapers or whatever, about creativity and resilience. And a lot of times these people make some money doing it, but maybe they're not huge, or maybe they've got another job, or maybe I like the strugglers, the
so
beautiful
tell me about
strugglers.
That. So tell me about that, because you know, hustling and struggling, that's Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And so
and
tell
I
me.
And I want to sort of honor that. And
interesting.
And I'm also listening, I also like, how do people do it?
That's a very
good
question.
How do they hang in there? What's helped them?
And why?
And why? And why do, you know, some of my most memorable exchanges are like, say if somebody's a singer, why do you love it? Like, I just a simple question like that, and they kind of have to think and frame and express themselves, and I often find that kind of really moving. It's sort of like people that have made a decision to be creative or artistic, and the road is not that easy.
It's never.
They've gotten the crap kicked out of them.
Everybody and has. Even somebody with successes has had the failure. There's nobody that has had successes without it.
And I'm very interested in how people navigate that road and why they hang in there and where they find the beauty in it. Because, you know, when I was doing magazine stuff, I loved it. And I loved interviewing celebrities. But it was a lot of times people that seemed to be on the top of the world. You know, I mean, you don't even know what's going on behind the scenes. But they were getting to do the thing that they loved. And they were getting well paid.
Of course. It's fruitful labor.
This shift into people that are sort of like doing something interesting and worthy and talented. And maybe they just haven't caught on or caught a break. Or how are they doing it? How are they hanging in there? And I'm also interested in why people do what they do, what fuels them, where their passions come from.
Well, I will be a fabulous guest on your podcast.
I can't wait. We're doing a cross-pollination.
We're going to do that. And
then I do my fun
answers.
Questions at the end, the observation deck.
Oh,
I bring out the cards and you pick your favorite ones. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well,
we're
really
going to do
excited.
That.
Thank you so much for sharing this story.
Thank you.
Today about rehab, because it's you are such an unlikely person to go through it, but I think that you did come full circle and there is a reason for everything.
Yes.
And it's given you even more tools to connect.
Yeah. I didn't belong there at all, and that was the place that I needed to be.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Huh, interesting.
There you go.
All right, listen, we're going to wrap it up right about now. I want to thank you guys so much for tuning in today. Make sure you tweet Dennis over there on Twitter at HensleyDennis, and then tweet me over there as well, and let him know that you loved his story. That was a great story. And I also want to thank all the sponsors on the show today. Really, you guys, check out my sponsors, because when you do, you're supporting me, and I appreciate that so very much. And one more time, on behalf of Dennis Hensley, thank you very much, friend.
It's my pleasure.
I really
enjoyed
it.
I love it.
And on behalf of everybody over there at Wondery Media, including Hernan Lopez and everybody on the Wondery team, my name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Story Worthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Story Worthy on iTunes and visit the Story Worthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.